When I was young, I used to break all kinds of components. Not only did I take things apart, but I took the components themselves apart and tried to make sense of how the heck they worked. I broke open capacitors. I broke open IF plugs. I did all kinds of things. Transistors were always a mystery. You know, if you really take the top can off of a transistor, it looks like a little grain of sand and a couple of very, very thin wires. So it took a while for me to figure that out. But anyway, we all use fuses. They come in all different kinds of sizes. They come flat, they come round, they come clear, they come opaque. Now, one of the particularly most common variety, in my experience, is the common cylindrical fuse. And one variation is the cylindrical ceramic fuse. So tonight's little question is, what will you find if you break open and look inside a high-quality ceramic fuse?
What is this fuse, Roy? What are we talking about, a quarter of an inch or a half inch?
Yeah, well, basically we're talking about the standard type of fuses that we all use for a lot of the equipment. Most of the time it's glass, but sometimes it's ceramic. So they're about an inch and a quarter, you know, little round ceramic instead of glass fuses.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know what that is. I know the fusible links that you had in the cars years ago. They were like ceramic.
What was the question again?
Okay, Wes, I'll repeat it for you. And with Paul, you know, we've all seen the small, I think they're AGM or something. This is a small cylindrical fuses. They have a glass so you can see the wire running through them, and you can tell when the fuse is blown because the wire is interrupted. So they also come in a ceramic version where instead of transparent glass, it's opaque ceramic. So for Wes, the question is, if you take the average, relatively inexpensive ceramic, a cylindrical fuse, and you break it open and look inside, what do you find in a ceramic fuse?
You're going to have a small hole there. But the wire in most of the ceramic fuses doesn't go inside that hole. It goes outside of it, so it's visible. And you can visually see if it's broken. And to experience.
Hey, Wesley, I'm assuming that we're talking about two very different fuses, because I'm basically talking about a fuse that looks almost identical to a standard tubular glass fuse, but it has a opaque ceramic outer layer on it that instead of glass. And the wire isn't visible in any of the ones that I have.
And one whitey wire, I've got to guess.
Okay, Hank?
I guess a coil of wires, isn't it? A type of wire that's round in a cylindrical fashion, evenly distributed within the ceramic tube?
Okay, let me add a little hint, maybe, to the question. This is, in addition to the piece of wire running through the fuse, there's something else inside a ceramic fuse.
Hydrogen.
Anyone else broken a ceramic fuse in their lives? Gosh.
I did many times. And we're talking about exactly the same one, but I did it in Europe mostly. So there was a small hole going through it. There was a wire. The wire could be in two forms. Let me drop. One of the form was that the wire was straight, or it was a flat piece of wire, and the other one was that it was in form of coil. But it was exactly the same wolfram, which is a tungsten wire. So I give up. I don't know what it was. It was in some of them, there was like a one drop of something. There was like the wire and was one drop of something. And to experience.
we're getting closer. We're getting one top of something. If anyone has any kind of guesses what that something would be, and it's probably more than a top, but there is something else. It goes back to really why anyone would want a ceramic fuse as opposed to a glass fuse. And as we all know, fuses have different types of ratings. The most obvious is the amount of current that they'll allow to flow and beyond which they'll open and block short circuits. Another is that there's a certain voltage rating on all of the fuses, which is basically the breakdown voltage of the case. So that, you know, if you take a fuse and you apply 1,000 volts to it, it's not rated for that. The current will jump right from one contact to the other side of the contact. But there's also another rating for fuses, and that's how high a current you can put the fuse in with it working correctly. Because if you put a small fuse in to a large current draw, what sometimes can happen is the metal can vaporize and apply itself on the surface of whatever the fuse is and act as a conductor. And so now you have a nice arcing high current going through your fuse that was supposed to be open. So this is something to use to stop that from happening.
I think I know what you're talking about. Let me drop. We have a fast fuses and we have a slow fuse. And the drop of something in the middle of the wire is from different material. It is made for that conductive wire to break exactly at the point when there is that little bit thicker drop of something. And it's, as I say, different material. And so it's here.
Okay, I mean, there's another factor with fuses, fast, slow, and intermediate flow rates. Depending upon what you're planning to power, some electrical devices have a starting current and calm down shortly after, and for that you would want a slow blow fuse as opposed to a quick blow fuse. But that's to act as a variable in fuses. But anyone else want to hazard any kind of a guess of what someone would put inside a fuse? You got a tube of ceramic material. You got a conducting wire in the middle that will break if the current is too high. What else would you consider putting in there that wouldn't blow anything up or make it better rather than make it worse?
You don't want the Google answer, do you?
Well, I assume Google has the right answer. If you want to cut to the chase and give me the Google answer, I leave it up to you.
The Google Meister says silica sand.
And as I've always said, Google is your friend, and Google very frequently is right. Yes, there is sand. And if you have a ceramic fuse, and I have a few, I'm sure everyone has a few, if they're good quality ceramic filter fuses, if you break them open and pour out, what you're going to end up seeing looks a lot like sand. And that's basically silicon dioxide, silica, it's sand. So that's the answer to the question. Usually, most other fuses, to my understanding, don't have sand in them. But ceramic fuses are built with sand in order to cushion the high current risk problem. That you don't get metal deposition on the outer surface of a fuse and produce arcing.
Google right now, and I found that something is a thin alloy. So yes, I didn't remember silica sand, but thin alloy. Alloy is that what's supposed to break first. Enter it here.
And when you first took apart a ceramic fuse and you saw this sand in there, I bet you were a bit perplexed as to what that was there for. Is that true, Roy?
Yep, I assume it's some fireproofing measure of some kind, but I was, it wasn't as confusing to me as the transistor. I think of all the things I ripped to pieces, the things that I didn't have a clue about were transistors.
IWS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Did you ever take an IC and try to sand it down and try to look for the little chip inside, and then take a magnifying glass, a real good magnifying glass, and look at it and still see nothing? That's what I did. I mean, I expected maybe I could see little, like, channels, you know, go from one location to another. It's all microscopic.
That no doubt would have confused me just as much as the transistor. You have to remember that this took place around 1963. Most of the broken things that people let me take apart and shatter beyond belief didn't have integrated circuits back then. They had discrete elements to them all. So I didn't have a chance at that point, and I kind of got past my physically abusive inquisitive mode. I finally purchased a copy of the ARRL radio handbook and read it from cover to cover, so I pretty much figured out things that way.
I have a question for both of you, because we were talking about the travel to the moon. How much water is on the moon per person? So that means how many people could use water for given for a period of time, let's say 1 year, till it ends and to extinction.
Was that the main one?
I mean, I'll defer it to you, Paul, because you know much more about this than I do. It was my understanding that the way that they found the water, they couldn't give a distinct volume. They gave a surface area, but they didn't give a volume. But Paul, please, feel free.
Yeah, there's enough water, theoretically, to equal, I mean, for the whole moon, to equal Lake Superior. You want to believe that, and that's the present theory. So it's going to last a long time. India, officially with their satellite going around the moon, is the first one to actually confirm it. You know what? We kind of knew it, but they had an instrument that I think it was a neutron meter. They measured the neutrons bouncing off the surface with their orbiting spacecraft around the moon, and they started it. And then, of course, we confirmed that as time went on, we have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter going around for the last 11 years now. And, but mostly in the craters on the South Pole, and that's why they want to go down to the South Pole. That's where you're going to find your biggest volume of water back to your Earth.
Okay, very good, Paul. The Wesley, any other questions about this?
Is there anywhere near equator? Because this is the most friendly. If you bury yourself, I don't know, 10 feet, not deeper than 10 feet, below the surface, then that would be between minus 24 Celsius and plus 23 Celsius. So it's quite friendly temperature. Is there any water available not far away from that area? And to
explain, it's not practical. You're better off on the South Pole.
Yeah, it's only at the poles where you have a reasonably controlled temperature. To bury yourself some number of meters below the surface would give you a constant temperature if it's sealed from the surface. But to do that excavating and establishing that habitat below the surface, you'd have to be on the surface for a month to do it. You wouldn't survive that month. I mean, it would take some very elaborate robot-like devices to dig the hole and establish your habitat in order for you to move into below the surface. You've got a chicken egg problem here. To protect yourself, you need a habitat below the surface. You can only get a habitat below the surface while you're establishing it, you're already protected. You see what I'm getting at here, Roy, how difficult that would be to do. Yes, it's possible to do it with a robot, but boy, that would have to be a very elaborate, expensive robot. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Do they have caves there?
Yeah, they have caves, but they don't go deep enough, they're not wide enough, they're not in the right spot, and even though you've got a cave...
Repeater, time out.
You've got some holes in the ground on the moon. I don't think they go deep enough. I don't think they give you enough protection. And just going down the hole is not enough. You've got to establish an insulated, airtight habitat down there, which is now isolated from the surface. So just having a hole in the ground, there's a couple of natural holes in the ground, and I don't think that's going to be anywhere near enough to do the job. Over to you, Roy. KQLIW.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, Dick, I agree with you. There's a lot of problems that need to be solved to make any of these things viable. I mean, if you'll notice what the other countries have done, they're relatively simple, straightforward, goal-oriented. Not one of these branching points where you could spend a lifetime writing an outline of all the things that you got to do for this. This is going to be very time-consuming, very expensive, and kind of probably in some aspects going beyond the envelope of our engineering ability at this point.
I don't understand one thing. $100 billion was spent for the first flight of the man to the moon. And that was $100 billion of that money, not today's money, if I understand it properly. Why shouldn't it be done now? Dr. Roy Beck.
I've heard $30-some-odd billion in 1969 dollars, which is well over $100 billion today, is the way I've heard it. Go ahead, Roy.
N1YDY.
Thank you. One second. Yeah, it was my understanding that these numbers of $130 billion are in present-day monetary value. It was only 30 only. It was only $30 billion back then. That was a lot of money. I mean, you remember how much people got paid per year. That was an awful lot of money. And to do something that we've already done, obviously, no one really wants to just repeat themselves. They want to do something better. And that's where it ends up costing a heck of a lot more.
Well, but that was for the whole space program. On the end of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, that's $30-some-odd billion.
Roger.
Okay, but I mean, you couldn't get there without that, could you?
Repeater, time out.
Yeah, Hank wants to say something. Go ahead, Hank.
I'm curious, because I read something that NASA put out on the Internet. It's on one of their web pages where they talked about using caves that were produced by lava flows years ago, and their comment on the website was that they would provide enough temporary shelter that you could have a prefabricated unit that was simply assembled there and not have the diurnal temperature changes. I don't know if they used the word diurnal, but the day-night temperature changes on the moon, as well as the radiation issues, if you use those shelters as your initial construction locations.
Just putting a habitat down a lava tube, I don't think is enough. It has to be completely isolated from the surface. Otherwise, that cold air is going to drift down there at nighttime, and the heat is going to drift down there in the daytime. People strongly misunderstand insulation. If, for instance, I've got a plant, my favorite plant cannot tolerate going below 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and I'm looking at the weather report, and for the next week, the temperature is going to go down to 10 degrees Fahrenheit on my property for the next 10 days. And my plant can't tolerate anything below 30 degrees. So I say, well, I'm going to put a good blanket over it. You put a good blanket over your plant. That slows down the rate at which it goes down to 10 degrees. It's still going to go down to 10 degrees. You put a blanket on a human being, you get warm because the human being is a continuous source of thermal energy. You're burning up 130 watts because of your metabolism if you're alive. Let me drop.
I understand the concept of thermal normalization. I just was reading a NASA produced on their own webpage. I'm not saying it works or won't work. But if you have something that's insulated and you have some sort of prefabricated energy source to keep it warm, I don't see why that wouldn't work just as a shot from the hip. I'm not an engineer. Actually, I'm not that type of engineer. And, you know, I just don't really see that there is something that is absolutely inhibited with our engineering level due to the pre-existing lava flow, at least the way they explained it on their website.
Are you talking about the slowing down convection by some kind of material that is holding the heat and converting it between day and night?
Yeah, thermal stabilizing techniques, which have been used on very efficient homes, you know, a great big water source, which absorbs the heat in the summertime and gives it back to you in the wintertime, on a cold night, so to speak. Possible. Darn difficult. I just don't think. I'm pretty sure Pence didn't get anywhere near the details of what he was saying. How about you, Roy?
Yes, thanks, Dick. I think it's a fascinating subject. I think you know, even non-engineers can talk about it and bounce ideas all over the place, and engineers could do that cube. It's a fascinating subject. I think it's deeply problematic. I anyone who kind of just says that you could sort of solve most of these problems with back of the envelope equations, I don't think they are familiar with the problems as much as they should. But you know, I wish them well. Again, I like more information. If I ever get a choice between less information and more information, it's always more information for me. Are there comments or questions on this subject, or we'll move on to the next story?
Something funny. What is the human brain capacity in terms of information storage?
That's a problematic question. There's approximately 100 billion neurons in your brain and my brain. Now, are they duplicating the data in different areas simultaneously, or can one neuron hold more than one bit of data? We don't know these things, and so it's anyone's guess. You can guess all over the place based on criteria that have quite been proven. There's a lot of data. It's not serialized the same way that a computer, a hard drive, or random access memory is. It's coded in a completely different way. There are all kinds of positive feedback mechanisms, negative feedback mechanisms, coordination of cells pulsating at a steady rhythm. It's really, really complicated, and there's so much about the brain that we don't have a clue about yet.
Can you compare it to any kind of digital data?
Not really, because you're talking not only apples and oranges, you're talking apples and rocks. Most von Neumann computers that we're familiar with, that I'm staring at right now, are based on a completely different serial architecture than our brains are. Our brains are built on neural networks. We have simulated neural networks of maybe 50 or 100 neurons in a circuit, but effectively, remember that 100 billion neurons. You can imagine what if you had 100 billion neurons to do a neural circuit for. So it's very difficult. People do it. People talk about, you know, how many petabytes of information the brain has. And occasionally I hear this terrible story that the human beings only use 17.3% of their brain, which doesn't mean anything and never did. You use what you use. The brain isn't sitting there idling. It's doing things. We may not be aware of it, but it's doing things.
More into the opinion that human will never be able to create a machine that will have a brain working at least like primitive brain of the men from 30 million years ago at Trajan.
Okay, Wes, so this is a little bit philosophical, and I understand that that's where this leads to. I could see a person making a case that one person's brain cannot possibly fathom making another one almost as good as its own. But on a philosophical basis, that doesn't necessarily mean that 1,000 human brains working together to increase their productivity and their abilities can't do something like that. So if it was a one-to-one correlation, I might agree with you. But, you know, if you have 10,000 or 100,000 very good brains working on a brain, you might be able to do it. I don't know if you'll do it better, but you might be able to do it close.
Thank you very much. No more questions.
Okay, very well. Anyone with any comments or questions, or once again, I will plow through to the next subject, and it's a fun one that a lot of people like. It's good old LIGO, the gravitational wave detectors and such. But anyone have any questions, feel free to ask them now. Very well. The LIGO and Virgo gravitational wave detectors are set to resume their hunt for gravitational waves on April 1st. That's tomorrow. This go-around, they'll be even more sensitive thanks to a set of upgrades to their lasers, their mirrors, and other components. This next run will be a big deal for different reasons than the first two observation sessions. We've officially entered an era in which two black holes slamming together in an unfathomable collision that sends ripples through space-time itself, ripples that we can actually detect, is now routine. But scientists aren't worried about most of the individual collisions anymore. Instead, they're interested in the behavior of our universe more generally, about how black holes can end up colliding, what kind of places in the universe are homes to these sorts of black hole slamming environments, and whether black holes grow through a sort of chaotic family tree of mergers. As we've discussed before, Albert Einstein first theorized that gravity could travel at the speed of light as waves rippling through space-time itself. After decades of dedicated search, scientists finally announced in 2016 that they had spotted the ripples created from a pair of colliding black holes using two 4-kilometer long, now that's approximately 2.5 miles long, L-shaped tunnels, with a laser beam passing through and reflecting back and forth 280 times thanks to a device known as a Fabry-Perot cavity. Special mirrors split the laser beam in two, then send the pieces back through either wing of the tunnel and reunite them into the detector. The detector senses the incredibly small ripples in space-time via a laser moving in and out of phase with one another. They can detect a change in length of one of its arms down to 1,000th of a proton's diameter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Just in case you missed the last line, they can detect a change in length of one of its arms down to 1,000th of a proton's diameter. The detectors have now measured 10 instances of black hole collisions and one instance of neutron stars. Incredibly dense objects around the mass of the sun, but the size of a small city slamming together. But merely sensing gravitational waves is no longer the most interesting piece of the puzzle for them. Now, these detectors essentially serve the same purpose as telescopes, but measuring gravity instead of light. Scientists have all sorts of questions. For example, what kind of environments have ripe conditions to bring two black holes close enough that they collide? There are two competing ideas. Either could be right. Perhaps pairs of black holes from binary stars that both collapse into black holes, or perhaps there are regions in space dense with black holes where they're close enough so that they collide. Astrophysicists can infer whether the black hole spins were aligned or misaligned during a collision based on the results of the gravitational waves produced, a characteristic that could help them figure out how they form. Let me drop for a second. A related question is whether black holes grow. The most recent data dump from the gravitational wave detectors came with a black hole with the poetic notation 170729, which is 80 times the mass of the Sun and larger than is known to be possible from a single star collapsing. This has made researchers wonder if black hole mergers are merely part of a life cycle of black holes. Do black holes have family trees and continue growing and doubling in size as more mergers take place? Well, a recent paper tried to determine the odds that 170729 was actually a second-generation black hole, the results of two mergers, assuming that there are globular clusters with lots of black holes living together. The result? It's possible, but more data is needed. And that's what makes the restart of the U.S.-based LIGO and the Italy-based Virgo restart so exciting. Let me drop for a second. If you think about it, we're extending our understanding not just of black holes, but of stars themselves. Stars, once they've reached the end of their lives as bright nuclear fusion powerhouses, might not just wallow in dim stellar corpses. They could enjoy rich, dynamic second lives as merging and growing black holes. It's hard to say at this time. The latest observing run will let scientists see three times more of the universe than the last observing run. Not only could that bring dozens more events, but there might be surprises that researchers didn't expect. There might also be more neutron star mergers, which would help us better understand the origins of elements like gold or the mysterious burst of gamma rays that scientists sometimes detect during these events. Whatever happens, it's going to be exciting, and no doubt we will be discussing it here. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2.
Light here is in time base. It's gravitational wave in time base.
I'm not exactly... But could you rephrase that question?
Yes. In 2016, scientists working in LIGO confirmed that the first detection of gravitational waves from the collision of two black holes, which is 1.3 billion light years away, happened. But then they had the other one in Italy, and that one since that time, which is 2016, supported nine or more gravitational wave sources. The question is, when we talk about light years, we're talking about time-based travel of light. Are we talking about time-based gravitational waves?
Okay, I'm not 100% sure what the question is. Light years is not a unit of time. Light years is a unit of distance. The speed of light at a vacuum is a velocity. Light travels in a vacuum at the speed of light. Gravitational waves, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, is that it too travels at the speed of light. And the fact that the electromagnetic signatures of the collision was detected at the same instant that the gravitational wave was pretty much supported that theory.
When you have a light traveling for 1 year through the space, you have a distance between point A and P that constitutes that 1 year of travel. My question to you is gravitational wave similar in that particular aspect to the light wave and to a field?
Yes, if the gravitational wave is one light year away from us, the same way that if the electromagnetic energy that's released during the results of forming the gravitational wave, they both travel for a year at one light year. in time and space. So I guess that's what you're asking?
That is correct. But there is another problem. Gravitational wave has nothing to do with electromagnetic waves. Why do they travel at the same speed?
Because, unfortunately, it's not the electromagnetic wave that determines the speed of light. The speed of light is a consequence of space-time itself. It's the maximum rate of causality that space-time permits. So the object that travels extremely fast ends up colliding with the boundaries due to the nature of space-time itself.
Technical question to you is, when you have a mirror at 4 kilometer tunnel or pipe, and the light returns unchanged, and the beam cancel each other, if the gravitational wave causes any tiny changes, then it won't. Do you know anything more about the construction nature of those tunnels? Apart from that, how big they are, I know how long they are. They are 4 kilometers long. And why they are in an L shape? And to here.
They're at right angles to each other. That's you know, another way of saying L-shaped is at right angles to each other, so that you can determine a degree of directionality of the wave depending upon which of the two reference lights change due to gravitational wave. If both of them change, you're looking at a 45-degree angle. If one changes and the other one doesn't change at all, you're looking at a 90-degree angle or a 60-degree angle, depending upon the detector. And you have three, now you have four. No, you still have three. You have two LIGOs and one Virgo to better triangulate what's going on. It's not exact, but it's decent. But it's basically conceptually something called the Michelson-Morley, I think, is an interferometer. It was designed over 100 years ago in order to prove that that ether existed, which unfortunately it didn't. And this one is much, much longer. It uses the mirrors to multiply the distance by 280 times. So not only is it traveling 2.5 miles, but multiply that by 280, because that's the amount that it bounces back and forth before it goes into the interferometer. And that's the gist. You have a beam splitter, you have a beam combiner, you have a Fabre Cabot mirrors on either end to multiply it 280 trips around, and that's the gist of it. It's much more difficult to make it all work well and to be safe and protected from environmental variability, but that's the underlying concept of it.
Well, we have a Washington State with LIGO, and we have a Virgo in Italy. Question is, how do they send the information and don't get the error? Because we're talking about a fraction, a humongously short fraction of the time. Interesting.
Don't believe they're connected in real time in any way. I think they both have a very accurate atomic time standard, and they're time stamping all their results, and then they compare them and make assessments based on that. So I don't think there's a hardwired connection, because then you'd have to factor in the delay time of propagating the signal from the United States to Italy.
How long is the event?
Again?
How long is the event? So we're receiving a gravitational wave. How long it is, in average?
I believe it's a matter of minutes.
Wow, this is interesting. Okay, no more questions.
Okay, very good, Wes. Anyone else with any comments or questions before I move on to the next one? And, you know, if you think that the last one was a wee bit confusing, we're going to talk about something called charge parity violation, which will be loads of fun. I'm sure you'll all enjoy it. Okay, Doug. Scientists have announced the observation of what is called a charge parity violation in a particle called a D-naught meson. This is the lightest particle containing a charm-flavored quark. This was done at CERN. The discovery will appear in physics textbooks for years to come. The universe is full of regular matter, also antimatter, which exists even here on the Earth, but there is a lot less of it. This new observation is important on its own, but it also takes physicists another step in closer in explaining where all the damn antimatter has disappeared to. Understanding charge parity violation requires starting from the top, or rather the charm. There are six kinds of quarks. There are the up quark, the charm quark, and the top quark. They all have an electrical charge of positive two-thirds of what an electron has. And it's also a down, strange, and a bottom quark, each with a charge of minus one-third of what an electron has. Each quark has an anti-quark partner with the same mass and the opposite charge, and the opposite parity, which you can think of as handedness. These particles combine into the protons and neutrons that create atoms, as well as a variety of other particles like D-naught mesons, a particle composed of a charm quark and an anti-up quark. Let me drop for a second. The laws of physics do differ if parity alone is switched, but should remain the same if charge and handedness are switched. This is what charge parity symmetry. And it basically says that it behaves the same when you switch a particle with a mirror image of its antiparticle. But one quirk about antiparticles is that they are annihilated along with their regular matter partner when they meet. And yet, there's so much more matter than antimatter in the universe. How did that happen, you ask? One potential explanation to explain why there's so much extra matter is charge parity symmetry violation. Examples where the laws of physics work differently: if you place a particle with another particle that has the opposite charge and the opposite handedness. Let me drop for a second. Charge parity violations were first spotted in 1954 in a particle called a kaon that contains something called the strange quark. It was a huge deal and netted the physicists James Cronin and Val Fitch the 1980s Nobel Prize. It was spotted again in the early 2000s in a B-meson, particles that contained the bottom quarks. Now, both the bottom quark and the strange quark have a charge of minus one-third. Charge parity violation has never been observed in a quark charge of plus two-thirds, even though it's predicted to exist by the rules of particle physics called the Standard Model. That is, it had never been observed until now. The Large Hadron Collider Beauty, LHCB, experiment that monitors collisions of high-energy protons at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland. These protons travel at nearly the speed of light, and when they slam together, turn parts of that energy into particles that then decay inside the experiment. LHCB physicists reported this a few weeks ago at a physics conference in Italy, that they had experimentally measured asymmetry in the rate of D-naught meson decay into other particles compared to the rate of anti-D-naught meson decay into other particles. For a second. Their analysis revealed that they spotted an example of charge parity violation, specifically in D-naught meson's charm quark versus the anti-D-naught meson's anti-charm quark. It was a teeny tiny itsy bitsy effect. It took tens of millions of D-naught mesons to see it, but it was actually there. Now, this may seem a bit esoteric to you and me, but it was a big thing among physicists that heard this announcement. It was a veritable champagne cork-popping announcement there. But, as generally is the case with particle physics, the story is far from over. Even with the new discovery, the charge parity violation we see and predicted by the standard model isn't enough to explain why all the antimatter disappeared and why we have more matter than antimatter in our universe. We need to find new phenomena in order to explain the full difference between matter and antimatter. So the team will continue measuring the amount of charge parity violations to see if it agrees with the amount predicted in the standard model or if it differs. And if it differs, it could be a sign of some new, never-before-seen physical phenomenon. So let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GF.
I went across a Russian article that explains it by balance. In the classical physics, they're trying to explain it, picturing it as a balance between two children being by an angle from two sides of the bar that is that has a point holding in the middle. So one was higher, one was lower, and they were trying to say, well, look, we talked about the balance between matter and antimatter. It doesn't matter if there is a real balance. It could be slopy balance, but still it's a balance, and this explains much more matter than antimatter. And to assume,
I couldn't put a balancing beam like a seesaw with matter on one side and antimatter on the other side. What would you make the seesaw out of to keep it from creating a reaction, if you know what I mean? So measuring mass parity of particles and antiparticles strikes me as a very difficult thing to do. You have to measure the mass by some of the means.
Well, they were trying to point that there is undiscovered mechanism similar to polarization wave that makes a balance by different principles into extreme.
Well, Wes, I think any attempt that doesn't use mechanics is pretty much doomed. If you go back to classical physics, you don't get the handedness, you don't get a lot of the underlying nature of antimatter and matter differences. So in order to kind of put it off to the side and come up with something else, and as Dick mentioned, I don't know exactly how you would even propose that experiment unless you then theorize null matter that doesn't interact with matter or antimatter. And now you're just making stuff up. So I think, you know, I mean, the 1800s was filled with guys trying to explain things before quantum mechanics was invented, because classical physics was breaking down and crumbling during that period of time. And I think going back to classical physics is not going to solve this one.
But the proposal was not about explaining things with classical physics, but rather pointing at the mechanism that's supposed to be discovered yet that is giving another explanation of balance, even though that balance is by an angle. Like in waves, we can explain certain things by using polarization. You don't have to be 90 degrees in X, and you don't have to be 90 degrees in Y. You could have electric field in the middle, or you could have a certain degree from the vertical, and it's still explanation. So it wasn't really by means of mechanical physics. It was rather pointing at possible mechanisms that must be there, but it's not yet discovered. And to a field.
Okay, Wes, I mean, again, everyone is free to have their theories. The problem is that if you buy into quantum mechanics, which has been the underlying principle of the standard model and physics for the last century, things are quantized, including spins and such. The angular momentum of an electron spin is either plus one-half or minus one-half. There's no fractions, there's no percentages, there's no zeros. It's either plus or minus all the time. It never varies. So that's the weirdness of quantum mechanics. So presupposing a more classical physical properties to atoms, I think, is going backwards, not forwards. But these symmetry-breaking operations will hopefully add more and more evidence that at points early in the universe, a lot of antimatter took a different route into its decay than matter did, and all the antimatter was turned into photons and other things. I think that's the ultimate solution, but it requires a lot more study and research and to see how other types of particles will decay in that asymmetrical way rather than going back to classical physics, in my humble opinion.
Very much.
Quite welcome, Wesley, and thanks to everyone who participated and listened, and I hope you learned a few things and were entertained a little bit. Before I hand over the mic once again, if you want to suggest any topic, if you have any puzzlers, because I could always use puzzlers, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And even if you have mailbag questions for Dick, you can send them to me and I'll give them to him. If you want to look at any of the links for any of the material that I covered tonight, it's roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And thanks again to Dick, thanks to Paul, and thanks to all the people that participated. And I will hand it off to Dick.
Great stuff, Rob Roy. I'm a little bit confused by that zoo of subatomic particles. Boy, there's a zillion of them. And to keep them all straight is not easy. You got to really study those. You've done that. Okay. We're going to go a little bit lighter. Not quite as theoretical, but the real hardware is what Paul discusses when he gives us a space report. He's talking about things that are really flying right now. WS2N, K2IW. You got it, Paul.
Very good. Yeah, either flying or maybe getting ready to fly. And, of course, the history of flight. We cover those three topics, the past, the present, and the future. This is WS2M for the Space Net Report. And very good on all the other topics Roy had. And I'm glad he covered the Indian story and the speech by the Vice President. Not that we don't have, we could cross those things off the list. Main topic for last week, we were talking about EVAs. Yeah, just on an EVA on the International Space Station on for NASA, on the NASA side. You know, Kaibots that do EVAs, they got one coming up in May. But on the NASA side, they had one a couple of weeks ago, changing out batteries on a space station. And this is an ongoing program with these batteries. You know, they started doing this a year or so ago, and they have probably a couple more years to do it. It all depends on when the batteries are delivered to the space station. They come up on the HTV cargo vehicle from Japan. Japan's putting these batteries, lithium batteries together and bringing them up, and these are all heavy batteries. Each one weighs probably over 300 pounds, and they're replacing batteries that are up there that are over 400 pounds. The good news is the ones that they're replacing, these nickel hydrogen batteries, take up twice the amount of room and twice the amount of weight. They're replacing, each time they go up, they'll remove 12 and they'll put in six. from the cargo vehicle. So they're always bringing up six at a time. A year or so ago, they had done 25% of the station and did just that, replaced six batteries on two spacewalks, three batteries each. You know, they added three lithium-ion batteries each time they did an EVA. And this year, again, they're doing it this last EVA was done by Ann McLean and Nick Hague. Nick Hague has just gotten up there. Ann McLean has been up there for a couple months already. They did an EVA and changed out, worked on this whole battery setup, taking removing the six batteries and installing three new ones, along with these big 70-pound, huge adapter plates, they call them, with jumpers on them. And they, what the jumpers do is they replace these, they have to get from one part to another because there's now less batteries, so they need the adapter plate and the jumper. Also, the adapter plate is saved, they're using it for storage to store some of the old nickel hydrogen batteries because, unfortunately, the cargo vehicle has bought them up, bought the new ones up. They don't have enough room to take the old ones down. They can only take nine down at a time, so that means every time this happens, they'll leave these three massive batteries behind, and they'll leave them on the same location, but they just won't be hooked up. So that's the name of the game. 25% was done last year, and then right now they're in the process of doing another 25%. They're doing the inboard section. If you look at the space station, there's this long truss section. It consists of 11 pieces going from the center all the way out to the starboard side and all the way out to the port side. And then you see these stores, they call them SAW. Each store is a solar array wing. So that's what it looks like. It looks like a big wing. So you have one solar set inboard from the center going out, and then another set on the outboard side, on the starboard side, and the same thing on the port side. So they're working on the port side now. The starboard side was done a year or so ago. So they're in tight, at least to the core of the station, and you don't have to go too far out. So with that, they had a successful flight this time with the new woman that went up. Her name is Christina Koch, and she went out with Nick Hague again. This was supposed to be the first time two women were going to go out on EVA at the same time. She was supposed to go out with McLean, Ann McLean, and Christina Koch were going to do the EVA, but they ran into the spacesuit sizing problem. Apparently, Ann McLean thought she would be happy with the larger set suit. Turns out, the next time she goes out, she would rather be in a smaller suit. They only had the smaller upper part configured for this flight. There is another smaller one up there. This way, both women could use it, but that's not ready. It would take like a month to get it ready to prepare it. It takes a long time to work on the spaces, and they don't want to delay the spacewalk. So rather than do that, they're just going to send out the one woman with the small space suit and the man, and that solves that problem. But the news media, of course, right away they were saying, no, NASA's doing this, doing that. They should have this ready and that ready. But what they don't realize, this has nothing to do with whether they're man or woman. It's just, whatever time frame they're up to, that's when they do the EVAs. For instance, this whole process should have been done probably 6 months ago. But there was delays. For instance, one guy that's up there now, Nick Hague, and and the Russian counterpart, when they flew up back in April, they didn't make it to the space station. They had to abort. So aborted, wound up back down in Kazakhstan, and they now got a second chance to go up. Now here he is. He's back up there. One of the things he was trained for was changing out these batteries. And now he finally got around to doing it. But this time he's up there with different people and space industry. Things change. So they're going to have to wait for that kind of breaking news.